TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Natural Process Farming, Bob Kanar. A satellite image off the California coast at night shows the lights of the western megalopolis, San San, extending from San Diego to Santa Rosa. Just like the eastern megalopolis, Chick-Pit, Chicago-Pittsburgh, and Boswash, Boston-Washington, there are very few places left in between that are not paved over. On the northern border of San San in Petaluma, Sonoma County, is the 140-acre Green String Farm run by Bob Kanar, who the bioneers describe as iconoclast, piano player, great cook, and an incredible farmer. His vegetables and fruit are so exquisite that they're sold in the most expensive restaurants, including Chez Panisse in Berkeley. His farm store is open year-round and sells produce and home-canned goods at affordable prices. As the cities are taking over the land, Kanar is taking back what he can. He's acknowledged by Michael Pollan as one of the important members of the sustainable food movement, creating solutions to the growing crisis of the loss of farmland, caused not just by urbanization, but by the techniques of industrial agriculture. Bob Kanar's workshop about natural farming at the first National Heirloom Seed Expo in Santa Rosa was packed. He responded to questions, beginning with a mini history of how the land around his farm was destroyed. Here he is, Bob Kanar.
Let's look at all the land between Santa Rosa, I mean real downtown Santa Rosa, and Petaluma. In something like 1860, John Muir came here. He was a big fella. He had a big horse, and there was Petaluma Hill Road. That was the main dirt trail from Santa Rosa to Petaluma. But he chose to ride his horse through the middle of the valley. He wanted to. He was an explorer, a naturalist. He got lost because the grasses were higher than he and his pony, and the soils were incredibly rich. Well, a few years later, the Rohnert Seed Company started into business and burned off and killed the interrupted the nutrient cycling. And that soil was like peat moss, and it's now called adobe. It's been killed. It's been beaten to death. Just time and time. You want to kill a soil, work it when it's too wet. If you pick up a handful of soil in your backyard garden, your farm, wherever you are, and you are going to cultivate it, and you can squeeze it into a little ball, stick your shovel or a fork into the ground, and take the soil off the tip of the spade and squeeze it into a little ball, and if it doesn't crumble with mild tapping, then it's too wet to work. One way to kill a soil for sure is to squeeze the air out of it, and the way to squeeze the air out of it is to work it when it's too wet. You ever walk across an agricultural field that's been cultivated and it's kind of crunchy, it's brittle, or you look, you're driving along and you see a freshly plowed field and you see all these lumps of soil that are shiny and glazed, well, it's been worked when it's too wet. Almost all of our soils have been excessively damaged by working when it's too wet, especially when there's no carbon in the soil. And what you want to do is improve the total mass of soil. Rohnert Park Seed Company quit because their soil went dead. And most people are building raised beds because the soil's clay, it's no good. Well, you realize the soil is clay and it's no good because it's been killed. But a typical raised bed in a situation like that is compacted soil and then a bed full of artificial growing media that is not biologically and mineralogically complete. And so if you wanted to grow gophers, you couldn't have a better setup. You have compacted soil where the gophers live underneath in your permanent walkways, and then you have a feeding zone for them. So, oh, we have to put wire in the bottoms of our raised beds now. And okay, well, some things have to be done along those fashions. But, you know, gophers travel at night and they're perfectly capable of jumping up and climbing over and getting into the raised bed. And so it's not the complete answer by any means. If you have all of your little precious backyard garden and work with the soil and get biology and food for the carbonaceous material, compost, all cover crops, whatever it is. You have a very small backyard garden and you have responsibility to feed a number of people. You can't grow cover crops. You can't grow the whole cycle as you might if you had a larger piece of ground. So there you have to base your carbon deposition and your carbon resupply on recycled material, i.e. compost. Compost from your own kitchen, compost from any waste stream material. When you grow atmospheric carbon into the soil, direct, it's pure. When you use waste stream material, well, then it's questionable. It can be very good, and we are doing a lot better. About 10 years ago, I helped start Sally a compost business here in the county, and she did very well, but then she wanted to retire, and she sold her compost company to somebody else. And the new fella, I bought one load of compost out of courtesy from him. I make my own, but okay, I'll buy a load of compost. And I spread it on a piece of my ground, and it was poisoned because the compost was made from yard waste, scraps, and cow manure, and it had some atrazine, a powerful, long-lasting weed killer in it, because people had used that in their garden, and it ended up in the waste stream material. And you don't know about the waste stream food stocks. You have to be cautious. You've got antibiotics and drugs, and you go out and get those manures from a non-organic, a commercial dairyman or a chicken operation or something. It's got all of that stuff in it. And some of those complex organic molecules don't break down very quickly, and they end up in your soil and in your food stock. It's better to grow cover crops. But if you can't grow cover crops and you have to use imported material, well, first off, your piece of ground isn't being totally responsible for itself. All of that compost, it was grown on another piece of ground, so that it's not sustainable. It's good to recycle everything, but it's not sustainable. And all that stuff was grown and sacrificed from another piece of ground and is now waste stream, so sure, recycle it and get it back into the soil. But nonetheless, you have to be very cautious about its purity. And most compost, like we've started these new compost systems. One of my friend Bob Schaefer is a great composter, lead master composter, and Jepson Prairie Compost. They get all of the kitchen scraps and yard waste from much of the Bay Area. They put it in trucks, haul it all the way almost to Modesto, where the compost yard is. It goes through machinery to extract plastic, because we don't know that we're not supposed to put plastic into the waste stream material. Big, expensive machinery to get rid of the plastic. A lot of horsepower, a lot of electricity. Then it goes through grinders, and then it goes out into windrows, and then the tractor, the compost turner scarab, comes and turns the compost, and it has to happen many times. And then the compost is finally digested and ready for use back to the garden. It has to be put on another truck and hauled back over here. It's almost all petroleum. There's a little profit, and there's a little wages, labor that comes out of it, but local composting is very important. We should have very regional. A city like Santa Rosa should have its own compost yard, not necessarily hauling it out there to the county yard. Same with Petaluma, and little towns should have their own integral composting systems where you can actually train people not to put plastic in it and not to use excessive anything in it. And everything that came from the earth, there's so much misinformation about composting. Everything that has grown from the earth and was on your table or any place is, it's not going to blow off into outer space. They say, oh, don't put meat into the compost. What are you going to do with meat scraps? Why, right into the compost. That's where they need to be. It's high proteinaceous material. It has to be handled properly. Organic mushroom compost is digested straw. You can utilize that without any problem at all. In the past, there had been a lot of problems with mushroom compost, because the compost itself that you're going to grow mushrooms in, it had to be sterilized. And so we used to use, for many, many years, we used to use methyl bromide, which is a rather nasty with a big-time residual in the compost. But now the mushroom compost is sterilized by heating and steaming and other non-toxic results. So yes, especially organic mushroom compost. It's not true compost. It's not a good compost. You look at real compost, it's totally digested. You can't tell what it came from. It's thoroughly, thoroughly digested. Digested sewage has lots of liabilities with it. We take an inordinate amount of pharmaceuticals, of very dangerous substances. And that pharmaceutical waste stream ends up in that sludge. You have to be very careful. We have gotten a lot better. It used to be very common practice when I was young. Oh, I had some passing interest when I was like 14 or something like that in photography. And so then I'm a little bit older, and then I go and get somebody is going to mentor me in photography. And what are they doing with all of their reagents for photographic development? Dump it down the toilet. Heavy metals right into the stream. You have to be very careful about sewage sludge, but we do need to utilize that stuff, and I don't think we do it correctly. Sewage treatment plant that is needs that waste stream of water. It's water, valuable resource. It instead of going to the ponds, I believe it should be pumped to the top of a dry, rocky mountain and allowed to percolate down and run, bubble, become aerated, and develop and get rid of the anaerobic biological population, just like a real mountain creek. That's the beginning description of natural process farming, is duplication of nature. And what happens, we'll look at water and rocks and biology. Water rains heavy in the mountains. And then around here, and this, it could be snow melt, but we'll just look at here. And we have wintertime rains. It rains heavier in the mountain. I'm on the side of Sonoma Mountain. This year, in the city of Sonoma, they said they had 34 inches of rain. We're at 80 inches up on the side of Sonoma Mountain. And the creeks ram down there, and the rocks are big in the high mountain. By the time they get to the ocean beach, it's degraded. The only thing left is the silica or the sand. Well, guess where everything else is? Either in solution or suspension. Earth is approximately 24% silica, and everything else, solution or suspension of the floodwaters. And this county and all counties' lands became very, the floodplain became very fertile because the minerals into the creeks and rivers and the rocks start big, and by the time they end up, everything else is in solution or suspension. Every time it floods on the land, why, then the land gets remineralized by the ground up mineral teas of the mountains. Not only are the minerals in there, but also all of the biology is in there, and the creeks are bubbling, and that's an aerobic digestive system. The biology and foodstuffs, if a deer dies, does anybody wander the woods and you see a dead deer, where is it? It breaks its leg, it falls down, and it's down in the creek. You don't see dead deer floating out because they're ground up in the mix. The rocks beat them up, and the skunks and everybody else, eventually ourselves, all end up in this floodwater. The mountain tea, the blessings of nature, and our cultures reject it. We go out, and Santa Rosa, where Santa Rosa is, beautiful soil. Where Imwalis is, up next to the creek, with their few acres that are left, beautiful soil. The soils that the city of Santa Rosa sit on are measured in a sortie index rating in the high 80s and low 90s out of 100. The best of soils. And it was all a big floodplain. We come in there, and we turn Santa Rosa Creek into a concrete line drainage ditch, rejecting the blessings of all of its mountain drainage up there. So naturally, the soil is starved of minerals. We plow it up. We don't allow any cover crops, or we don't recycle and bring carbon back to the soil. The biology of the soil falls and collapses. I used to know a fella, Pietro Paoloni, and he came here in 06, and he was an Italian fella, a head gardener for Imwali, who was getting old, and he did that for about 10 years, and then he gave up because of the bugs. Well, the plants, soil died, and the plants became starved, and he didn't have any real strong bug killers yet. We had not yet developed Dow Chemical and so on, all those bears and those allies, and so he gave up. He just totally gave up, and he bought a big chunk of land, including, I believe, what we're sitting on in the vet's building, and he had a little house over there, and he grew a little bit of a garden, but he gave up being a gardener. We can't grow stuff here. Well, I bring him some broccoli, and he'd smell it, and he'd taste it. Where'd you get this? Well, it was grown with good digestion and good mineral compounds, and so we reject the blessing of nature, so we've got to bring it back into play. So we have to feed our soils with full-spectrum mineral resources. And finally crushed volcanic rock, quickly cooled volcanic rock, has everything in it. Not enough sulfur, because in the system, sulfur is very volatile, so it escapes and forms up sulfur-bearing rocks separate from the magma. Sulfur is very, very volatile and very important. And also, calcium is not an igneous material, it's a crustal material, so we need small amounts of finely crushed igneous rock and small amounts of calcium-bearing stuff, and such as oyster shell from Jericho Dredging in Petaluma, or your eggshells that are thrown into the blender, any calcium, many calcium resources. If we overcome those deficiencies, and we also, that's what the river used to do. Also, we inoculate our gardens with indigenous biology. So that means that you go up into the mountains, into the parks, any place, go into Howarth Park and find a rotted log and get a little tiny handful of compost from underneath the rotting log and a little bit from many different resources, any place that's pure and clean. And you bring that home, and it, ideally you can do many things with it, but bring it home, put that one little baggie that you put in your back pocket into a 5-gallon bucket of water. If you live in the city where the water is chlorinated, fill the bucket and let it sit out for a few days to get rid of the chlorine. You still won't get rid of the very toxic fluoride. What do they poison our water for? I don't know, but that's what they want to do, degrade us. So I think so. We're mentally incapacitated. And put that compost into the purified water and stir it. And then strain that into your watering can and put it, sprinkle it all over your garden, and you will begin to inoculate, you'll have to do it more than once, but you'll begin to inoculate your soils with the indigenous microfloral population of your region, of your watershed. And so you're inoculating your garden so that you have good digestion, the potential of improving digestion, and you're feeding your garden the raw parent material with the mineral substrates of the rocks. And that's an excellent beginning. You've got to overcome the deficiency. Nature's really a wonderful thing, and we're kind of cracked up. We had this last year a beautiful volcanic eruption from some little earth zit known as a volcano, releasing pressure. And it blows out a beautiful cloud of ash that covered all Europe. And they're complaining because of a little airplane interruption. And they all just got remineralized. Germany would be dead. Those soils would be dead if they didn't occasionally get that natural remineralization. And we need to mimic that. And we could have allowed the nature to do it, and we didn't need to build Santa Rosas of this world on the real floodplain. We could have built them on higher ground and let that floodplain be a sustained floodplain and holding the water, but we reject it. Now, the third part was water, and don't reject the water. Hold the water. You know, we talk about rain barrels. That's a good thing. Our houses should have cisterns underneath them. There's no deficiency of water here in the West. In Sonoma County, we have an average of something like 30 inches of rain. What do? We dig ditches and we drain it all off, and we reject that blessing of nature as well. Just get rid of it. We should have many little farm ponds. I have one farm that has two little farm ponds on it. They fill up in the first rain in the spring. And then the river ever just goes away for the rest of the year. And I get about 300 acre feet totally, and it's enough to irrigate about 400 acres. Just that one little bit. And little off-stream farm ponds. I'm not suggesting building dams on living creeks. These little farm ponds are built in swales that are not year-round drainages. And to hold the water with the land, very important. To open the land. I have one little hillside piece right above my little shack house that when I first came there in 76, it had a big ditch along the road and three 12-inch culverts, and the soil was so compacted by all for people and nothing for nature process that those three 12-inch culverts in the ditch were oftentimes not big enough, not large enough to take the runoff. And so then the muddy water, the erosion load off of this little 2.5 acres would go out on the road, and then I'd have to get the shovels out and scrape the road, clean it up. Well, today, after growing cover crops on it, breaking it up a little bit mechanically with the chisels on the tractor, growing cover crops on it, and it's just like a piece of natural mountain. It rains on it one night last 2 years ago, 6 inches in one night. No runoff. It soaks in just like in nature. It's like a sponge. No, there is no ditch. There are no culverts. There is no runoff. And eventually that water will soak up in the foundation of earth, and it'll come out as a spring someplace else downstream and be purified as it moves through the earth. Water, mineral nutrients, soil biology. These are the three things that I recommend first and foremost. Really, here in Sonoma County, our spring is is our fall. That's when it rains and that's when the land turns green. And the winter time is the best growing season here. All of the root vegetables, all of the leaf vegetables, the salad plants, the chicories, the lettuces, all of these things, the winter is absolutely the best. You don't have to water, you hardly have to do anything. It's you plant them and they grow. And so many gardeners here we come from a mindset of inheritance. And so we grow a summer garden and that's it. We grow a few tomato plants and then the garden sits bare and empty all winter long. There are lots of backyard summer gardeners that could go out and plant diversified cover crops. Yes, you want some of those small ones. You want some quick germinating things that are nurse crops. The little poa annua, bluegrass, little annual bluegrass. It only grows up about this big, makes lots of seeds very quickly. That holds the soil and nurses the higher level of cover crops up. The second ones coming up after the little marigolds, calendulas, and grasses, and many different kinds of small, quick-growing nurse plants. Up through them come the higher level of life support plants, perhaps the mustards. And the mustards grow up and they bloom out by January or February, depends on the year. And up through them, another cycle comes up through them. The high protein grasses like oats and wheat and barley. And up through them come the even higher level, longer to live, deeper blooming plants like the fava bean and the bell bean and the vetch and the pea. And the vetch and the pea use the dead, already leafed out, lived to its maturity, set its seeds, the dead stems of the mustard plant. They use that as a trellis. And the little plant nurses the other ones up and protects the soil from washing away and heaving and cracking under cold weather. And they don't add much in terms of organic material, but they help early. It's very important. They might only add 500 pounds of finished organic material. The mustards aren't really heavy either. They might only add 1,500 pounds. Then the proteinaceous, high proteinaceous grasses, they're very, very carbonaceous, and they may add several tons. And then finally come the long-standing legumes. And that's not only the top, but the root, and those plants are living there and sponsoring biology in that soil, pumping sugars and amino acids and all sorts of complexity into the soil their whole life. And if you allow that cover crop system to come to full maturity and die of its own volition, there you've got the durable, long-lasting carbonaceous structure, steady state, just like you find in nature. And you do that for a few years, and pretty soon you'll have good living soil. And those plants die of their maturity. They die of internal contentment, and you are also incorporating physical contentment into your garden space. And there, you're well on your way to resuscitating a damaged piece of soil and returning Sonoma County soil lands back to their inherent fertility, the potential of their inherent fertility. Where do you see a piece of ground under nature's control that's bare? You don't. You can take a rock and a deer can urinate on a freshly split rock, and if it's in the shade, moss will grow on it almost immediately. If it's in the sun, it'll get lichens. And after a few years, you'll peel back that moss and scrape the rock. I'd like to give you a homework assignment. Go home and find in your travels, in your digging of the soil, a naturally occurring rock. Not a piece of crushed road gravel that's been incorporated or anything like that, but a naturally occurring rock, a piece of nat nature that's been in contact with the digestive forces of the soil for a long time. And get your pocket knife out and scrape the outside of the rock. And more often than not, if that is a fertile rock, the outside of the rock will be all soft and digested, and you'll be able to scrape it very readily. All of the minerals have been taken away, and the thing that's left are the silicaceous clay platelets. And then get your hammer and split that rock open and examine the inside of the rock versus the outside of the rock. And you will see in many cases, most cases, the inside of the rock is freshly broken. It's hard, and it might even have some crystalline shiny stuff in it. And lots of times you'll actually see zoning, like rings against the moon or something like that, as the biology is penetrating into the rock. This is the foundations of life on planet Earth, good mineral nutrition, good biology. That's what we need to incorporate into our gardens. Now, the genetic material, I'm going to strongly recommend that you buy seeds that were grown with selection from the wild nature. Let's look at the carrot. The carrot, the wild carrot on the banks of the Mediterranean is a poisonous plant. not really deadly poisonous, but it's toxic. You have to be very cautious about eating too much of it. It has medicinal value, but it's not a food crop. Well, that wild carrot has given up its wildness in order to have a relationship with a deal with humanity. It's given up its expression of wild genetics and its domesticated genetics. It's been selected mostly by the female of our population for thousands of years, and now we have this beautiful, soft, flavorful, sweet, colorful, nourishing root from the wild. All of that genetics, the foundation of all of our genetic material, is absolutely wonderful, and it is, you get a package of carrot seed. Let's say that you use Danvers carrot seed or Nantes carrot seed, doesn't matter, old-fashioned, open-pollinated. It has a wide range of genetic diversity. They're all good carrots. You'll get out of a field of an acre of open-pollinated carrot seed. Some carrots will be big. Some carrots will be have some little diversity. You know, we're all have a little bit of diversity here. They won't all ripen at the same time, perhaps. They'll have a diversity that allows them to grow well under a wide range of less than ideal soil-like conditions. You don't want them to all ripen at once. You growing a home garden, you want to have this diversity. You want them to ripen over, let's not look at the carrot, but the cauliflower. You can go out and get hybridized cauliflower seeds, and they're all going to ripen on the same day. Where if you plant an open-pollinated cauliflower like a dominant or snowball or something like that, one of the old-fashioned ones, you'll harvest them all winter long. What do you want? You're trying to feed yourself. It's cauliflower time once a week all winter long. Open-pollinated, old-fashioned plants that have been selected and nurtured for their successfulness.
That was Bob Kanar, a working farmer based in Sonoma County, California. He grows some of the most exquisite vegetables and fruit, while at the same time growing soil that gets richer every year. Greenstring Farm in Petaluma is one of the farms he manages, and the associated training center, Greenstring Institute, accepts interns year-round. Come back when TUC Radio returns for the conclusion of this amazing talk. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. TUC Radio has moved to Northern California. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. You can get information on how to order a CD or a film on DVD of Bob Kanar by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation, CD or DVD order, keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD or DVD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.